Well, when you work through the book of Proverbs and the series that's there, it'd be really easy to feel that now we have the corner on wisdom. We know how things work, and everything is going to work pretty much like clockwork, kind of 2 + 2 = 4. As we've seen for the last couple weeks, and Brother Sam Saldivar opening Ecclesiastes to us, there is a disruption to that order that God has put in place that we have to realize as part of the reality in a sin-cursed world. And tonight, we want to also note that the order is not just disrupted, but a lot of times that order is hidden. We have difficulty understanding what God is doing because often what God is doing, he hasn't made known to us. What do we do with that? So tonight we're going to actually do what in seminary they call a book study. We're going to cover the book of Job very briefly. Now you are worried and you are perplexed. The title of the message is The Perplexing Ways of God. So I'm looking at the clock saying, why am I starting at 6:25? But I'm planning to go through this as quickly as possible, and I think that my goal is that we have a perspective on life that's accurate and therefore helpful for us as we often deal with perplexing things that where God is hidden. It helps correct us from making wrong conclusions, giving pat answers, and actually being harmful in the lives of other people and misrepresenting of God. Now, what I want to do is just read together. We're going to go through some representative passages in Job just to kind of get an overview. We're going to read straight through. I might comment here and there just a little bit, but mainly getting a sense of the overview. And then very quickly, I want to run through some lessons learned or some observations from this book that I trust will end up helping equip us for the perplexing nature of some features of our own lives. So we're going to start in chapter 1, in verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. And when the day of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there was none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. As chapter 1 continues, Satan ends up destroying Job's oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his camels, his servants, except for the one servant for each of those categories who reported the disasters. And then worst of all, his 7 sons and 3 daughters, all destroyed. Job 2, verse 3. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. All that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with a loathsome sore from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. And his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women who would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naphtalite. They made an appointment together to come show him sympathy and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept. They tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. Job suffered the loss of nearly everything we hold dear in life. Most of us will suffer the loss of one or more of these gifts at some point in our lives and go through suffering that feels similar to what Job went through. But Job's case, in its extremity, was meant to teach us that even in the greatest of losses, the truths unveiled in this book, named after him, will hold true. It is wisdom for us to heed them. So as Job processes this, in Job 3:11, he comes to this point of abject despair that we could perfectly understand if we think what this would be like. Why did I not die at birth and come out from the womb and expire? In Job 6:8 through 9, oh, that I might have my request. Oh, that God would fulfill my hope, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. To experience this level of pain, we can all understand why you'd want it just to be over or never to have existed at all. Job 4:6 through 8, his friends begin to try to teach him. They can't figure out why he's going through this, and their conclusion is that it has to be that there's some secret evil in his life, or else this wouldn't be happening at all. This is their math. This is how they're figuring out the equation of why God would bring this into his life. And so we have a sampling of that through much of the center part of the book. And so in Job 4:6 through 8, one of his friends says, is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. In other words, that's what's happening in your life. In Job 8:5 through 6, if you would seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. Or Job 11:15 through 17, surely then you would lift up your face without blemish and you would be secure and will not fear. You will forget your misery. You will remember it as waters that have passed away, and your life will be brighter than the noonday. Its darkness will be like the morning. Job 22:4 through 5. Is it for your fear of him that he reproves you and enters into judgment with you? Is not your evil abundant? There is no end to your iniquities. So that's basically the tack that they take to encourage him. Now remember, these are friends that wept with him. These are friends that sat with him for 7 days and seven nights. These are friends that are distraught about their friend's difficulty, and yet they can't figure out how it fits with the orthodox wisdom that they've been taught. By the end of the book, God shows up. And God talks, and God speaks. And Job's response to God, Job 42:1-3, Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted, And then he quotes what God had said. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. So part of Job's confession here is that I just didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand it from the beginning, and I was trying to make sense of it. And basically, God's answer has been, you know, basically, where were you when I laid the foundation of the world? And there's a whole lot of things you don't know about, and you don't have to know about this. Job 42, 7 through 10, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz, the Temanite, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right. Now you read the chapters upon chapters of what they said, and a lot of it you're saying, well, wait a minute, that's true. Like this is the way it works, right? These are like proverbs of the way life works. But he says, you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now therefore take seven bulls and seven rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Nephite went and did what the Lord had told them. And the Lord accepted Job's prayer. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. And it goes on to enumerate all that God gave him. So that's basically, in a nutshell, the story of Job. What do we make of it? Here are some things I jotted down with some sub-points to it. And so I'm going to give you writer's cramp. I guess you can watch it again on sermon audio. First, what's evident from the beginning is that the spirit realm impacts earthly existence. What sets up this whole thing is what's happening in heaven in this contest between God and Satan. We learn from their discussion that God knows his people and that Satan hates God's people because Satan hates God. We also learn that God puts limits on what Satan can do. And if you look at the book, just like the 30,000-foot view of what's going on here, you look at the beginning, you look at the end, God wins. And this conflict between God and Satan is a significant and important conflict. Consider what your hope would be if Satan wins. So while from the earthly perspective, this seems like an arbitrary wager, when you step back into the spiritual conflict, the conflict between God and Satan is a significant conflict. And God wins this conflict. The spirit realm impacts earthly existence. Number two, suffering changes how we view life. Suffering can make us wish we were dead or were never born. This is a righteous man. This is a man who loves God. And the despair that he voices is what suffering wrings out of us. This is what it's like to be human and to suffer deeply. Suffering can make God seem far away. Much of his complaint through the book is that, you know, where is God? Why doesn't he explain himself? And he feels abandoned. And suffering, and perhaps this is the biggest thing, suffering naturally makes us ask why. Everybody's asking why. I mean, the whole middle section of the book is, why is this happening? And just to give you a little clue about what we're going to find out, that's still the question that comes to us after we've read the book. Why? And so in answering that question, number three, moralism is not the answer. This is the perspective of Job's friends. Moralism is not the answer. First off, moralism does not explain why the righteous suffer. Moralism says if you do right, good comes. You don't suffer. So it doesn't explain that, and it's a reality of life that righteous people suffer. Moralism does not explain why the wicked prosper. Now, the wicked suffer and righteous prosper, but the fact is there's lots of anomalies, right? There's lots of seeming contradictions. Wicked people prosper. People that curse God and hate him live to ripe years a lot of times and are famous and wealthy. Why? If I live by moralism, moralism can't answer that question. Moralism further tries to speak for God on what he has not revealed. And God doesn't like it. We see that at the end of the book. And moralism increases the pain of those who suffer. Pat answers, make the suffering worse. And a lot of times, as we see our friends and loved ones suffer, we want so badly to fix it. We want so badly to answer for them why, that we end up saying things that actually hurt them rather than help them, because we end up trying to answer questions that God hasn't answered. We don't have to answer the question. It's okay. It's okay to sit with your friend and pray with them, suffer with them, sit with them in the cave, as it were. It's okay to do that. You don't have to tie it up in a bow. You don't have to make it okay. Moralism is not the answer. On the other hand, cynicism is not the answer either. No, curse God and die is not the way to deal with this. Cynicism, in other words, it's all absurd. There's no point to it. No good deed goes unpunished kind of thing. Cynicism fails to recognize the goodness of God. Just because Job suffered didn't remove the reality that God was good to him. In fact, if you look at the way the story tracks, you see God showing great goodness to him at the beginning, great goodness at the end. And the suffering that's in the middle is what we struggle with, right? But cynicism fails to recognize the goodness of God. Cynicism also fails to acknowledge the wisdom of God. There is design. There is order. There is a degree of justice. There is a sense of beauty. There's so much that speaks of God's wisdom as well as his goodness. And cynicism fails to appreciate the limitations of human understanding. What do I mean by that? It assumes that if I can't figure it out, then there must not be an answer. It assumes if I don't know the answer, then there can't be one. It assumes that God is obligated to, if he's good, to tell me everything that he's doing. So cynicism fails to appreciate the limitations of human understanding. Number five, here's the conclusion. We don't have to know why God does what he does. We don't have to know that. I mean, if you think about it, just think about the definition of who God is as an infinite being. I, as a finite being, do not have to know why God does everything he does. My position is not to stand in judgment of God. I don't have the capacity for that. Tim Keller, in his March 22nd devotional entry, says, finally God appears and speaks. He simply declares that he has created and knows all things, and no one else does. Job expects an explanation. His friends expect a condemnation, but God gives neither. We don't have to know why God does what he does. God gives. These are some anomalies in the book, right? These are some things we don't know. God gives and God takes, and both are beyond our understanding. Why did God make Job so rich? Why didn't God make me that rich? Although I don't know what I would do with all those animals. I would have trouble. God made him amazingly rich at the beginning and at the end. I don't understand that. Why did God do that? I don't know. It wasn't because Job earned it. It's because God gives. And God also takes. We know this thing was going on with him and Satan, but I think as human beings, that doesn't seem enough to us. Why did God do it the way that he did? Why did he give Satan as long a leash as he did? God gives, God takes. Both are beyond our understanding. But there's something else buried in the course of this story as well. Sin is atoned for by substitutionary sacrifice. The sins of Job's friends meant that they had to give a burnt offering. Why? Why should a substitute for me take care of my sin? There's only one reason. God decided it would be that way. God decided it would be that way. Because if I got what I deserve for my sin, I would be the one being killed, right? I would be the one being punished. So there's more that we don't understand about life than we even imagine. Sin is atoned for by substitutionary sacrifice. And here's something else even more amazing. For God's people, even death will be conquered. And we find that great passage that we'll read in just a moment in Job 19, where Job refers to his Redeemer. The Redeemer, Jesus Christ, was completely innocent, and yet he suffered human weakness and hatred and betrayal and torture and death. He is able to redeem us because his suffering paid for the judgment we all deserved. No one can be righteous enough to escape eternal condemnation. Moralism will never get me to heaven. So he took our place and gave us his perfect righteousness, his life, his kingdom, to be received by faith. Cynicism won't get me to heaven either. He has redeemed what seemed irredeemable. And so Job writes in Job 19, verse 23, "Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another." You realize Job got his wish? We have read from the book that bears his name and records his words and his ordeal. And millions have gained spiritual insight from his life and his suffering. Satan's purpose to destroy him and to dishonor God failed. All Satan ended up doing is making Job famous for all time as a premier faithful servant of God. And Job has been with his Redeemer for centuries now and waits for Resurrection Day when his body will be raised immortal and incorruptible. So, if you are perplexed by the ways of God, welcome to life as it really is. You are facing the difficult nature of human life in the present time. You don't need to know all the answers. And you don't need to interact with other people as if you do. You will misrepresent God and hurt them. Live on the basis of what you do know, however deep your suffering, however long your trial, and leave the rest to the God who knows all things and knows you. Even the grave will not keep him from redeeming you. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. And Lord, none of us would ever want to go through any of the things that Job went through. You've let really all of us taste parts of what he went through. In the course of a lifetime, we do. We learn something about your perplexing ways. We learn the humility of knowing we really can't figure it all out, and we can't pretend that we do. Lord, help our faith in you to remain strong. Whatever you choose to bring into our lives, help our compassion for others that suffer to be deep. Help us help them and not hurt them. Lord, help us receive from your hand both what you give and what you take, and to praise you, knowing that when it's all said and done, the suffering will be gone, the tears you'll wipe away, and we will live in a resurrection life that will never suffer again because of our Redeemer, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray.